Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast in hours two. And welcome to 2023, another glorious year for us here at Queens. I am, of course, your co-host TJ, the ever gracious, effervescent, emotionally needy, overwrought, hyperdramatic, melodramatic Pisces. And this is my co-host.
And I'm Aaron.
Who is the...
the other person who hosts the podcast.
Who is the similarly large personality Aries. That's actually not true. He is one of the most subdued people I've ever met. But he is still an Aries, so do with that what you will. We aren't yet in Pisces season, but we'll be there soon. But I won't belabor it too much. But we are very happy to be back with you after having taken a bit of a hiatus. We have now been to Scotland since we were with you last, mm-hmm. which was a lot of fun. Very gay-friendly country, which I really appreciate.
Yep.
Lots of beautiful men, which I also appreciate. Mm-hmm. If you're listening to us from Scotland, welcome. So, all of that aside, we've got the housekeeping taken care of for the moment. What movie are we talking about today?
Well, spoiler alert. We're talking about spoiler alert.
That is correct. We are talking about spoiler alert. Based on the Michael Osiello sort of autobiography memoir called Spoiler Alert, The Hero Dies at the End. Just came out starring Jim Parsons and Ben Aldridge. Do you want to... how would you summarize this movie? I mean, I guess I just kind of gave away the big plot point, but...
it's every gay movie from the 90s plus Sally Field.
As if she isn't into the iconic gay movies of the 90s. I gesture you toward Mrs. Doubtfire, for example. I guess So My Nose is what, the 80s?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Anyway, it's not important. We'll get to that later because there is clearly some intertextuality as we make our way through this movie. So yes. As this movie's title suggests, it's a shortened version, which is interesting. But if you've watched the trailers for this movie, you knew going in that the character was going to die.
Like spoiler alert, dude.
They don't shy away from showing that you're going to be emotionally devastated when you watched it, and even knowing that, I was still quite emotionally devastated. Now, to be fair, I'm often emotionally devastated at Hallmark commercials, but anyway. So, when this movie begins, we have Jim Parsons, who's playing Michael Osiello, who's working at TV Guide, which is, if that didn't tip you off that this movie is set in the late 90s and early 2000s, mm-hmm. nothing else would. I don't know that anyone even relates to TV Guide anymore.
Does TV Guide still exist?
I'm pretty sure it does, yes. Like, but I don't think...
We should have done our research.
We should have done... I mean, it does still exist. I know that for a fact, but it is not the sort of cultural touchstone that it was. It's now been... like, the way that TV Guide functions in the narrative is that, you know, it kind of provides, like, fluff content. Like, Michael Osiello is, like, writing puff pieces, mm-hmm. basically, for them. But... when he goes out to a bar, he meets Ben Aldridge's Kit Cohen. The two fall in love, slowly, and then have a 13-year relationship. Their relationship hits the skids, and then it turns out that Kit is diagnosed with terminal, I think it's rectal or colon cancer. Mm-hmm. And so they have to grapple with what that means, and, you know, they go through treatment. Ultimately, unfortunately, as, you know, as I've said already, Kit dies in the end, and Michael has to deal with his grief. Mm-hmm. So, there's a lot to talk about in this film, so I thought perhaps we could start, as we typically sometimes do, with the performances, because I do think that, you know, that's a good way in, since they both reveal so much.
Yeah, so who's do you want to start with?
Well, let's start with Jim Parsons, because I really appreciate what Jim Parsons is able to do with his performance mm-hmm. as Michael, and perhaps it's because I identify with Michael so much, like, a little buttoned up... both literally and metaphorically, mm-hmm. You know, working at a kind of, I wouldn't say a dead-end job exactly, but he's not writing necessarily the kind of hard-hitting journalism that he might like to be writing.
Yeah.
You know, he's writing listicles, essentially, mm-hmm. which, as a listicle writer myself, I can identify with how challenging that can sometimes be. But I think that, you know, one of the things that Parsons excels is at creating these kinds of characters, but, mm-hmm. you know, there are shades of Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory here. There's even a few of his character from Ryan Murphy's Hollywood.
Good, yes.
But I appreciate, and even from Boys in the Band. Like, mm-hmm. there's, I mean, these are kind of like the big trio of roles that Parsons has been known for before this. But I just think that he's so good at making these characters understandable, these kind of neurotic, mm-hmm. anxiety-ridden characters,
yeah,
and making them not stereotypes, but really full of complexity.
Mm-hmm. And I come around on this. I actually felt a little bit differently about Parsons' performance. I actually wanted to see something a little bit different from him, since he's already known for, of course, for Sheldon, and then, of course, for playing those other characters that you talked about who were actually queer in those stories as well. Seeing him play this again, it felt a little bit like repeating some of the same performances, and that's not always bad. I mean, it's like the characterization that he chose for Michael is spot on, perfect for that character. I don't, mm-hmm. I don't feel like his performance was inappropriate, but part of me just kind of wanted to see Parsons sort of reach out and do something a little bit different. But that said, I'm fine with the choices he made.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think that, like, it's nice, because there's a lot that he can do with his face, like, because Parsons is a very unique face. Like, it's not a face that you would consider, like, classically handsome.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something very, I don't know, there's a tension that I often see in his, like, the way that his performance manifests,
mm-hmm.
that I think is, you know, helps to us to understand how really tightly wound these characters are.
Yes.
You know, you see it obviously with Sheldon most notably, but you even see it in his character in The Boys in the Band, who is really high strung.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, unlike those characters who tend to be very, have an edge, I do think that Michael is a little softer than those other characters.
Yes, like he's, definitely.
There's a lot of trauma because Michael has lost both of his parents, his mother to cancer. You know, he's close with his brothers, but they live in different states. You know, he calls himself, what does he use, the FFK, like he calls himself a former fat kid.
Yes.
When, in a conversation with Kit, when they first start hooking up, you know, that he has all these body anxieties, which kind of persist throughout his life. And I think that, you know, it's to Parsons' credit that he really kind of excavates those hidden mm-hmm. depths of that character.
Yeah. And I definitely want to echo the kudos you're giving to him for the performances there, because I feel like the script left a lot out. And so, I want to echo what TJ's saying here, sort of giving Parsons credit for bringing that out of the role. Because there are lots of little things, like with the character being the former fat kid and all of that kind of stuff, that sort of, sure, it's like, yes, he was a chubby kid. He's played by Jim Parsons now, so he's quite slender now. We don't really see him doing much to make that happen. We just get the references to him having
right.
been. And that's the fault of the script.
Yeah.
That's not something that the performer can sort of make up for and sort of fulfill what the script didn't do. But that said, I think the performances did a good job of making me not care so much that the script left out some more establishing moments.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only kind of hints that we get as to how he got there is the fact that he's a runner. Like, we see him running quite often, mm-hmm. like, particularly with Kit's mother once they start bonding. So I think that that's what the script intends, that to carry mm-hmm. that weight, if you'll forgive the pun. But I don't necessarily think it does it.
Yeah.
Especially successfully, but
especially since he makes such a big deal about still having the lingering issues, which I understand
right.
they still have that, but there's not even like him sort of, there's not him even like fretting about what he can eat for dinner or not eat for dinner, that kind of stuff.
Right.
That might have made it feel like, it might have made it make more sense that the character is still dealing with these things from his past.
Right. Now, I will say that he also has really good chemistry with Ben Aldridge. Now, I'm familiar with Ben Aldridge, but I don't know him, like, super well. He's really hitting a stride now. He's in another movie as we speak. But he is just, he has an effortless charm to his performance that mm-hmm. I really appreciate. Like, he brings to Kit someone who really is comfortable with himself, but also not. Like, mm-hmm. he's even more, like, each character has their own burdens to bear. In Kit's case, it's because he's not out, and that Michael is his first, like, actual love and relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, in some ways, this is just something that occurred to me. I'm getting to wonder if maybe this movie, as satisfying as I found it, would have worked better as like a miniseries. Because I think that would have given it a little more time to sort of elaborate on each of their characters mm-hmm. in their relationship, which otherwise is conveyed through just a montage, mm-hmm. which is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it would have helped, I think, address some of the problems that you're identifying.
Yeah, that's it, too. I don't know that I want a miniseries. I feel like I got enough content. and if there was something truly interesting about the characters, I might want more of them, but they're all fairly sort of, just sort of narrowly drawn characters that you'd expect in a movie like this.
That's true. Yeah. So anyway, as I was saying, like, I think that Ben Aldridge does a really good job of capturing Kit, and there is an undeniable chemistry between the two. And, you know, I've said this on this podcast before, but I really appreciate when gay movies focus on gay intimacy. Like, there's nothing wrong with gay sex, and believe me, I love a good gay sex scene as much as the next person. And more than most, I dare say. But I really appreciate that we have these moments of intimacy, like that's actual intimacy between mm-hmm. these two characters. Like when they first go to their apartment, to Kit's apartment, and are starting to, you know, get hot and heavy. And then, you know, Michael freaks out because he doesn't want Kit to see his body. But then they just sort of start talking. Mm-hmm. But then the talking leads to like sexual encounter. Like that mm-hmm. is really nice.
Yeah.
And I think that it's nice to see that in a movie.
Yeah.
Like that kind of representation of gay intimacy.
Yeah, for me, it felt very familiar. That's how lots of my experiences were with right. folks when I was playing the field back in those days. You know, there was a lot more of that than I think a lot of folks would suspect for people if you're not mm-hmm. if you're not used to sort of going out and having more casual type encounters. How they're not just sort of, let's just do this physical act and move on.
Right.
That often there is this sort of bit of bonding that happens. You actually get close to one another a bit.
Right. I mean, that's how I mean, personally, like, I like to talk to people in addition to the sexy bits. Like, it's nice to have a conversation. And I appreciate that the movie went that route and turn and helping to flesh out their relationship. Mm-hmm. And I also appreciate that, like I said, Eldridge is just really charismatic and classically handsome, mm-hmm. but he carries it really lightly. Like, he's not model pretty, mm-hmm. but he's definitely, like, handsome, like ruggedly yeah, handsome.
Exactly.
And I appreciate that that's the kind of person that we get with Kit.
Yeah. And I also want to give Aldridge credit for the role. Obviously, the kind of role that he plays here is the one that's it's award bait. Mm-hmm. So of course expect all kinds of accolades for him. The thing that I wanted to say about that is that he has so much he has to do mm-hmm. and so much he has to show. His character arc is a huge curve. So he's got to come around a lot. And that's a challenge for an actor to figure out how to hit each of the moments for each part of the movie so that your performance to sort of makes sense in a way that builds in a way that makes sense for the action. That's not easy to do when your character has to do so much. Uh-huh. And I want to give him credit for pacing, how his character develops, especially through the end where before he goes, he has to admit to some things that he had done in the past. And I was looking back at the performance and I was thinking first, I was like, his performances feel a little bit flat to me early on in the movie. But I was like, no, he was actually sowing the seeds for his regret later on. And I'm like, that's really good pacing for an actor. So kudos to him.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have thought about it that way. But now that you say that, I think that's spot on. Like analysis of how his character and his performance and the character mesh mm-hmm. in a very seamless and organic way.
Yeah.
And I, like I said, there's an effortlessness between this kind of mismatched couple that I feel really works and mm-hmm. they both sell it so well, which, you know, really is captured in both the comedic moments and the dramatic moments. And I think that the film actually does a good job. Like, unlike, and I actually disagree with some of the critics who said that like it, that, as unlike most dramedies where the comedy and drama is blended, that this film separates them out. I actually disagree because mm-hmm. I think that it finds the comedy in the really dark moments as well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I think that part of the reason that works is because the film seems to really understand how gay relationships work and how complicated gay relationships are and how they're not just like straight relationships. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of the scene, you know, after Kit goes for chemo and, you know, they go to the room where the chemo chairs are and there's no bed, which they were expecting. Mm-hmm. And then Michael storms out to the nurse's station. He's like, give my husband a bed. And of course it's an homage mm-hmm. to, you know, Terms of Endearment, I think. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Shirley MacLaine's climactic moment. Mm-hmm. And then Kit says that was Oscar worthy.
Yes.
And someone, like some critic sort of lambasted that scene, but I was like, that's exactly what I would expect of a gay couple. Well, like,
exactly.
That's exactly what a gay couple would say. Mm-hmm. Like, and I felt that that was really authentic. I thought yes. that was an accurate I mean, if, for example, God forbid, one of us were to be in that scenario. Well, let's be real. If one of us was to storm up to the nurse's station and use that line, it would probably be me.
Yes.
you know, that's not the kind of histrionic attitude that you would take in these circumstances. But you would say to me, that was Oscar-worthy.
Exactly.
Or, okay, sure. Like, that's, yes. Like, those are the kinds of things that gay men would say to each other, mm-hmm. particularly in a moment of crisis. So it's that line of criticism, I was just like, didn't hold water, because I was like, that felt to me authentic, as yeah. do so many of the struggles that this couple makes. Like, we see them in their honeymoon stage, but then also when things fall apart, and mm-hmm. they have to, because when Kit's diagnosed with the cancer, they're in the separation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the film is kind of brutally honest.
Yeah.
In showing how difficult gay relationships are, just like straight ones.
Exactly. And since you say that, let's back up now and actually talk about the progress of the relationship then. Because we kind of jumped ahead a little bit. But you were talking about how, of course, they meet, they fall in love, they have all that. They get into the relationship. And we see how that develops, but we have a time skip in there. But we see how that develops, and then they settle into what seems to be this, you know, sort of happy, functioning relationship. Actually, let me go back even before that, because I jumped over the skipping head. Early in their relationship, they have to do the whole meeting the family thing.
Right.
Easy for Michael, because his parents are no longer with him, so there's nobody for Kit to have to meet. But of course, Michael has to meet Kit's family.
Right.
And that's what brings us our two other wonderful stars for this movie.
Right.
But of course, when that scene happens, we get that nice subversion. And I wanted to bring this up now to start talking about some of the themes of queer movies of the like of the late 90s, early 2000s, at the time in which this movie set. How so many of them were sort of the queer tragedy or queer drama of some kind that dealt with one of a handful of common tropes, right? So here we've got the not being one partner's out, one's not out. How are they going to handle it? Is the one going to come out, and how is it going to go?
Right.
So we get, of course, the centrality of the coming out narrative. We get that baked in there because Kit's not out to his family. And of course, because the movie wants us to move ahead, we don't take a lot of time establishing what the family's reaction is going to be. We get there pretty quickly, but we get what kind of reaction? What? How do the parents respond?
Well, the father, who is played by the great Bill Irwin, is just like, that's great. We're really hip. We were going to go to Woodstock. And, you know, just sort of
yes.
Effusive, more accepting, like, Midwest dad.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Sally Field, who plays Marilyn, is just like, how could you not tell me? Do you think I'm a monster that I wouldn't mm-hmm. accept you? And, like, and deliver these in the kind of way that only Sally Field mm-hmm. could do. And my God, that woman is a treasure. Like,
yes.
To, if you're listening, Ms. Field, which I don't think you are, but if you are, we love you. We really do. Like, so I just love that moment because it is just so funny. Like, it is a really amusing moment when Kit just blurts out that Michael is his boyfriend.
Hmm.
And it's arguably one of the funniest scenes in the whole movie because they have this awkward moment where clearly Kit's parents are like, who is this guy?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because at this point, Kit has had appendicitis mm-hmm. and, you know, has been brought home. And then they have this awkward conversation where Michael tries to explain what he does, and then they don't understand TV journalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've had that conversation yeah, before.
Right. And Michael keeps doing stuff around the apartment that indicates that he knows, like, where
right.
everything is.
And that's the other thing they subvert it, or play with, is the idea of de-gaying the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that's something that happens in literally every gay rom-com of the 90s and 2000s
yep.
when parents come to visit. And so I love what both Bill Irwin and Sally Field are able to do with this role, and I appreciate that the film just let them accept their son. Like, we didn't have to get with all the other messy
mm-hmm.
drama that's so often involved with coming out stories.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I haven't read the book, but maybe that's the true-to-life story. But if it is, kudos to Kit's parents for being so accepting.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, I mean, even though Sally Field is not a major player in this movie, she is still brings a lot to the role.
Yeah.
Not just, and partially because, in large part because she plays in so many of those lovely, weepy melodramas that many of us loved from the 90s and the 80s, Steel Magnolias being the most notable example.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she plays grieving mother so well.
Yes.
And I think that but she also plays warm and accepting mother. Like, she has this warmth and just radiance to her that I think allows the role to shine even more than the script necessarily calls for.
Yes.
Like, she didn't have to go that hard, but she does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she makes the soup, and, like, her immediate response when she finds out about Kit's diagnosis is, you're going to fight this and you're going to beat it. And then, you know, when she says goodbye to him at the end, like, I can't even talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little overwhelmed. But anyway, because she's, you know, she says, it's okay, we'll be okay
yeah.
without you. And, like, if that scene doesn't break your heart, I don't know what will.
Exactly. If I had a heart,
that
it definitely would have broken at that moment.
I was sobbing, but that's no surprise. And Bill Irwin, too. Like, even though I don't think he's necessarily given as much time to shine as Sally Field is, I think he still does a lot with what he's given to kind of convey, you know, a father's grief whenever he also has to say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that both of them bond with Michael as much as they do with Kit. Like, I love that they seem to truly adopt him as one of their own. And yes, that's a huge deal. Like, that is, it's not emphasized in the film. Like, Michael doesn't make a point of talking about it, mm-hmm. but it's something I think that's so important to see in terms of representation, to see a gay guy's parents truly accept their partner.
Yeah. And I actually like that the movie didn't belabor the point too much, that it just sort of made it be a thing that mm-hmm. happened, because I like how that sort of normalizes the idea of acceptance. It's like, right, you don't make a big deal out of it because, frankly, that's how it's supposed to go.
Right. And then to go to what we were saying about this way it subverts some of the tropes and narrative conventions of gay movies, that not every gay story, even a tragic one, as this one is, mm-hmm. doesn't have to involve all the trauma. Like, yeah, exactly. It doesn't have, not every milestone in a gay life, in a gay relationship, has to be filled with trauma and dark things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really good to see. Yeah. So I think that, and arguably, you know, the most notable trope that this film plays with is the tragedy one. Like, because mm-hmm. obviously, Bury Your Gaze is one of the oldest tricks in the book when it comes to popular culture. But this one, I mean, obviously, it's based on the book, so there are kind of limits as to how, mm-hmm. you know, what it could do. But I appreciate that, you know, it doesn't shy away from that. And I think that it really helps to see that grief and death do happen in gay relationships, but they don't have to be because the person is gay. Like, it's not like, you know, so many other stories, you know, he wasn't hate-crimed or any of those mm-hmm. other things. You know, it's just people get cancer, and sometimes when they're really young, and that really sucks.
Yeah.
And you have to really grapple with what that means. And I think that that's a story that's worth telling, and I think that it's symptomatic of how far gay representation has come, that we can have those kinds of mm-hmm. stories. I think that's important, because I think those narratives need to be told.
Yeah, I've been saying that for years in the bit of academic work that I've done on these kinds of subjects, where I'm just kind of like, it's so important that we have these stories that are about all aspects of our experience, and not just the things that sort of define us as gay or queer or anything like that, but all of the other stuff too, because all the other stuff is our lives as well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because I'm thinking about the scene, one of the, you know, more poignant scenes very early in their relationship. Michael has, you know, exploded Christmas all over the apartment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he says that he gets under the tree so he can look up at the beauty, and he fantasizes about being with his partner for years later, that they're getting old, but they still lie under the Christmas tree to appreciate the beauty. Mm-hmm. And he does it, you know, he gets, what does he say, 13 rather than 30, or mm-hmm. something along those lines, that he gets 14 rather than 40, that's what it is. Yeah. That he gets 14 Christmases rather than the 40 that he would have liked. And I, as you may know, have a sort of melancholic spirit, and there was something I felt really powerful about that line, that, mm-hmm. you know, when you go through life, you do sort of assume that you're going to have many years with your loved ones, but sometimes you don't, and that really sucks. Like, and it's really hard to sort of grapple with. I mean, it is hard for me, at least. I'm a person who doesn't like to admit that people die. So I felt that that was one of the film's really sort of more profound revelations, is that you just kind of have to accept that.
Yeah.
And that's really, you know, I don't know if our listeners know this, but I have a trouble sometimes accepting things that I don't like. And so, you know, I felt that Michael's struggle was something that I too, that resonated with me, I guess is how I would put it.
And of course that, you know, his struggle at accepting all kinds of things are bound up, not just in sort of the unwillingness that any of us would have to accept, you know, the loss of someone we so deeply care about. But it's, of course, it's bound up in the losses that he experienced as a kid himself. First his father dying, and then his mother dying of cancer after that. You know, that sort of baked into his backstory that this is going to be the thing that's hard for him to deal with.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I'll get to this later in the deep cuts, you know, when I talk about why this movie resonated so powerfully with me. But, you know, when you've had to deal with cancer and loss, like, it really can be overwhelming sometimes. And I appreciate that what Parsons gives us in this performance, and so does Aldridge, are two people really struggling to overcome their reticence to make themselves vulnerable, but they each manage to do so. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this point where, you know, very early on in their relationship, Michael says something to the effect that I'm afraid of you. I'm afraid you're going to break my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not Ben, but Kit is similarly afraid that, you know, Michael is going to make him explore parts of himself that he never knew that he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And who hasn't been there? I mean, there is a sort of radical vulnerability that being in a relationship, particularly in a gay relationship, calls for. And I think that that's one of the things this film is able to really evoke and sort of explore in a particularly sophisticated way.
Yes, definitely.
You know, because obviously there are many gay relationship movies, but rarely do they sort of, are they quite this emotionally honest?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if, I think that's a big part of the reason this film is so absolutely wrecking for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a sensitive creature. I don't know if you know that, but you know, these kinds, I knew going in this movie was going to devastate me, and it very much did. But it's not all sunshine and roses for this couple. Like, you know,
I think the audience got that part already.
Right. You know, so about 10 minutes ago, we were alluding to what happens after the flash forward, when it becomes clear that actually these two people who, the diegetic people, audience, and the audience outside both think on the outside they're quite well, when in reality they're separated.
Mm-hmm.
And we get this lovely, like, sort of montage of their kind of ugliness toward each other during their therapy session.
Yes.
And that's another of those moments that I think is pretty bracing in its honesty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this is not a perfectly sanitized relationship, but two people who have grown apart over, you know, 13 years, that there are differences that you have to cope with, you know, mm-hmm. when you get that deep into a relationship, particularly a gay one. Not to generalize or stereotype, but let's be real, like 13 years with two men, gay men together is like, you know, 50 years of straight years. So
I know we've already been together for what, like 300 years?
Yes, exactly. It feels like it. I kid, of course. But I mean, that is pretty, it's played for laughs to some degree, but it's also quite harsh, like the way they sort of take digs at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real, though. Like, I can definitely imagine those kinds of honest conversations you would have in the, you know, in the privacy of a therapist's office.
Yep.
You know, that they talk about Michael works too much, Michael doesn't want to have sex, but Kit,
mm-hmm.
You know, Kit also, you know, also has his problems. And so there's all this stuff that, you know, that's revealed in this montage. And, you know, sometimes these kinds of montages can be very lazy storytelling, but I thought this one was effective.
Yeah.
And I thought it was effective because it so skillfully blended together the comedic and the really shatteringly devastating, mm-hmm. you know? And sometimes people can be really ugly to each other.
Yeah. And for me, what I liked about the montage is that it sort of encapsulated what the movie as a whole does, where it lays very out there very clearly. These are two people who love one another, but the question is will they be able to make their relationship work?
Yes. And I think that's a really, again, one of those profound moments that this movie excels at. It's quietly stated, like the therapist is like, I mean, it's clear that you two love each other.
Mm-hmm.
You love each other too much to let each other go.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to spend time apart to see whether this is worth putting back together.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, kudos to that therapist for giving such good advice. But I do think that that's one of those other kind of uncomfortable truths that people don't always like to think about, that you can love someone quite a lot, even romantically love them, but you just don't work as a couple.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it turns out that Michael and Kit do work together as a couple, but only because of tragedy. Like,
mm-hmm.
if Kit had not been diagnosed with terminal cancer, would they have worked out? I don't know. But, you know, I think that that's a really interesting point the film raises.
Yeah.
And so, of course, one of the key things that, you know, drives them apart is Kit's flirtation with Michael's nemesis, the Ben, what is it, calls him the Tom Daly lookalike.
Yes,
he calls him the doppelganger, which he doesn't really
look at him at all.
He doesn't look like Tom Daly or Tom Daly at all, but be that, he's very attractive.
Yes.
But, you know,
that's just another manifestation of Michael's insecurities more than anything else.
Right. Which I want, again, something that as a deeply insecure and anxious and anxiety ridden person, I was like, yeah, I can see why he might feel jealous of this young, attractive man, which as it turns out, he has every right to be, because Kit does confess to having had an affair with him, or mm-hmm. having had sex with him, whether or not it was an affair per se is not exactly germane, but it's, you know, a pretty haunting moment, but it's delivered in such a way that, you know, at this point, we know the kid is dying. And so Michael makes what I think is a pretty emotionally mature decision to be like, I forgive you. And then they get married.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's, you know, a pretty abrupt thing, but I can understand, like, why when confronted with the enormity of death itself that you would just be like, you know, this doesn't ultimately matter. Mm-hmm. I just want honesty so we can, you know, embrace this last part of our lives with dignity and not have all these things hanging over us.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing how clarifying that can be for folks to have to face a situation like that. Because when you were asking before about the, you know, without the diagnosis, would they have been able to make the relationship work out? For me, the question is, without the diagnosis, would they have even bothered to try to figure out if they could? Or would they sort of just kind of keep putting it off because they have time to sort it out? With the diagnosis, there's no illusion of time anymore.
Right.
You can't tell yourself, well, I'll think about this later, or maybe down the road I'll be open. You can't do that.
Yeah, and I mean, I will say that some of the most difficult scenes in this movie to watch were the ones with the diagnosis. Like, I mean, again, we know what's going to happen because it's in the title and in the trailers, but there's still something, it's, the way it's framed dramatically is just so devastating. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the first diagnosis and then each subsequent one where, like, the chemo's not, your body's not responding to the chemo, the radiation just bought you some time, but, you know, mm-hmm. I mean... Like I said, when you hear those, it's one thing to imagine it, and Michael is a wishful thinker. Like, he wants so badly for things to be different that he's willing to try to manifest it just by strength of will alone. And it's really quite devastating to sort of see him not, to see his recognition that that's not going to work this time. Yeah. That it never works, but it's, you know, it can be very haunting. And I mean, as someone, again, who I identify temperamentally with his character, and I understand the temptation to always reach out for hope, it can be really difficult to accept that there is no hope. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a really, really hard thing to come to terms with.
Yeah.
But I think that that's one of the things the film does well, is to sort of show Michael's ability to do that. And part of, you know, what allows him to have that moment, you know, in his final moments with Kit, he does this thing where, like, he just imagines for a moment that this is all just a TV show. Because, mm-hmm. you know, Michael, as with many people who grew up in the 80s and 90s, a lot of their self-perception was filtered through television.
Yep.
Through sitcoms and in dramas in particular. You know, so we get this moment where he's having an interview with Kit as if he's just a character in a TV show that's being written off. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, for some people didn't like that moment, and they didn't like the sort of break cutaways to when Michael is imagining himself in a sitcom to sort of cope with the trauma of the present. But I actually thought that was, it made sense character-wise for him to do that, because he's obviously, and made clear from the beginning how important TV is to him, not just as a career, but as his entire way of making sense of the world is framed through television. And so that made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it robs that moment of its real, like, I think that what people wanted was just sort of a traditional death scene, but that this made more sense to what we've been given for Michael as a character.
Yeah, I didn't hate it at all. I can see the basis for some of the criticism, but I think criticism is a bit overblown. Like I said, I didn't hate it. I thought it, I just generally don't like the device of the, let's just for a moment imagine a different ending, but we're not, but it's not actually going to be the way. Not a fan of that device, period.
Right.
But this has probably been my favorite way I've seen that done in something.
I mean, again, I as we know, I personalize everything. I can't help it. That's the kind of critic I am. Live with it or medicate me, as Sophia says. Like, I can imagine myself, maybe not that exact frame, but I can imagine if I were in Michael's point of view that I would rather imagine the alternative than deal with the reality.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, and I think nicely done, it's actually that that allows him to kind of accept the Kit's passing. Yes. Like, that's the one thing that allows him to sort of really accept it. Because
mm-hmm.
Kit accepts it much sooner than Michael does. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, Kit breaks down when he finds out that it's, you know, pretty much terminal. And, like, the sounds of his weeping are pretty hard to listen to. But, you know, when he's given, like, what, 6 months or whatever it is, you know, Michael still scrambles to try to find some new experimental thing. Mm-hmm. And Kit's like, no, I don't want to do that. Like, I've already made peace with it. Now you need to as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty devastating line.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I can see why someone like Michael would have so much difficulty really sort of accepting that.
Yes, definitely.
But for me, like, I think arguably the most beautiful scene as Kit is, you know, lying in bed and slowly fading is, like, the moment when Martha reaches out and, like, takes Michael's hand in her own. Hmm. And then, you know, Bill does it too. And I was just like, wow, that is really powerful. I'm actually getting a little worked up, so I'm going to move on from that point because I don't like to cry on air. It just was a moment of, like, real, like, emotional honesty and mm-hmm. authenticity that really sort of helped to suggest and show how much these characters really love each other. And I think that's really nice. And I, you know, credit again to Sally Field, who just exudes so much warmth in that character and in that role.
Yes, I suppose if you like sentiment, it was a wonderful moment.
Well, see, that's the thing that I get frustrated with some of the criticism. And I, you know, when I like a movie, I will leap to its defense, as my listeners know. And I did find that, like, a lot of the criticisms of this film were that it was tonally inconsistent or that it was too sweet or that it was too saccharine. And I'm like, God forbid we have feelings. Like, God forbid we have a movie that deals with death in a way that's honest, but also, you know, emotionally kind to its characters. Like, mm-hmm. I don't exactly know what critics want if this isn't going to satisfy them. I don't know. I find those lines, I sometimes worry that, you know, critics have kind of lost sight of the ball at this point. So, to move on to something a little lighter, two things, actually. One, and this is light but also dark. So one of the things that Michael does that I think is really gracious is give Sebastian the chance to say goodbye to Kit in the hospital. If it were me, I would have thrown that little bitch right out of the hospital window. So if anything punctured the sort of sense of realism in the movie, that was it. Like, I'm not sure what couple would be like, yes, you have certainly had sex with my husband, but I will definitely let you see him before he dies. I would not do that. I don't know, maybe other people would.
Yeah. Now, for me, it actually seemed quite realistic for someone, especially someone who has experienced the kind of loss that Michael has experienced. Like, he understands that on a level that, fortunately, most of us don't. That, you know, having lost both of his parents while he was still a kid. I don't see him getting in the way of anybody's grieving.
Mm.
So for me, that actually seemed ultra realistic for his character.
Oh yes, I was mostly being facetious, but I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that I would never do such a thing. I'm not always known for being the most gracious mm-hmm. when it comes to those kinds of circumstances. But on a lighter note, I also think that this film really nicely captured the experience of what it was like growing up in the late '90s and 2000s, like, because it begins what in like 2000, or like 98, 99, 2000, something like that, thereabouts, yeah. And goes to like 2013, I think. And I think it really nicely captured everything from the Kylie Minogue, like, mm-hmm. playing at the dance club.
Yep.
Which, you know, a long time ago, when we first started this podcast, I reprimanded Mark for not knowing who Kylie Minogue was, which was still devastating. So, Mark, if you're still listening, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's just, you know, there are so many things that I think capture the sort of feel and texture of life back then, whether it's using actual digital cameras, like one of Kit's favorite sort of devices is the digital camera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are moments where he's constantly taking photos of the world, which I thought was a nice touch. You know, and all the other ways that we have kind of forgotten, like, it feels like a different world.
Yeah.
Even though it was only, what, 20 years ago. But it feels like a lifetime ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the film did a pretty good job of capturing what it was like to grow up and to date and to be gay in that particular exactly. period. Like, it was a different kind of life than we experience in our post-Grindr, now constant social media world.
Mm-hmm, but it was nice to get a glimpse back at that world.
It was. I mean, obviously, you know, as Kit goes through his treatment, Michael has posts on Facebook to family and friends that, you know, and you could see how wishful thinking they are, because he's mm-hmm. constantly being like, oh, Michael, or Kit's doing so much better. The treatment seems to really be working, but it's obviously projection. It's just another symptom, or it's symptomatic of how often Michael makes sense of himself and his circumstances through mass media,
mm-hmm.
including the last thing I wanted to mention as far as light things was his obsession with the Smurfs.
Yes.
I can't believe we didn't mention this earlier.
Mm-hmm. I was going to, before we pivoted, I was going to make sure that we talked about
it. But we can't finish up our main discussion without talking about the Smurfs. So, yeah. Would you like to elaborate what happened?
There was a whole lot of Smurfs. I don't know what else to say. Whatever amount of Smurfs you're imagining, it's not enough.
That's true. Because Michael is very ambivalent about letting Kit come back to his apartment. And when he finally does, it turns out the reason he was so, like, resistant was because he has a bit of an obsession with Smurfs. Mm-hmm. There are Smurf figurines. There's a giant Papa Smurf. Like, he identifies with Vanity Smurf.
It's all over that apartment. I'm sure art department loved getting all of that Smurf stuff to shoot this scene.
Right. I mean, and it's obviously played for less, but I mean, it's one of those moments that I think does double duty. One, it's very funny to see Michael's in his 20s, maybe 30, pushing 30 at this point, still be obsessed with Smurfs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like, you know, he uses it because, as he says himself, it's my way of getting in touch with the world when it was still simple and I didn't have to deal with, like, grief and loss and all that stuff. Like, it takes me back to a more innocent time. And nothing says I came of age in the late 90s and 2000s than going on eBay. I mean, eBay was ubiquitous back then. Mm-hmm. We all know people who lost control of their spending impulses on eBay.
Yep.
I bought computers on eBay. But, you know, it's just an amusing, like, sort of time capsule of what life could be like whenever you were, you know, 20 in 2000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was also just nice. It got me thinking about, you know, the past. Like, we were saying how the movie does a good job of just sort of reminding us of that time. It reminded me, I had an ex whose apartment I never saw.
Well, now and you know why.
I like to tell myself now that it was because it was full of Smurfs.
So I'm going to assume that it was more along this line than not the Monster Dahmer, Jeffrey Dahmer story. Like,
well, I'm still here, so.
Well, you said you didn't see his apartment, so maybe now we know why.
Right.
So, lastly, I just thought this was a very well-shot film. Like, there's a lot of really beautiful scenes. And so Michael Showalter, the director, I think has a really keen eye for how to make a scene work. And fun fact about this director, did you know that he is the son of acclaimed and very renowned literary scholar and feminist theorist Elaine Showalter?
Are you asking your audience? No, they didn't know that.
Well, I'm asking you. I know you know this because I told you before, but I was hoping you would... Ugh, never mind. Take a cue, why don't you? But anyway, so it's just interesting. He's also, you know, directed a lot of other things, but I was just like, surely he can't be Elaine Showalter's son, but he is. But I just thought this was a very thoughtfully arranged film. Like, there's a lot of really nicely put together scenes that I think work really superbly.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's Michael and Marilyn, or what's her name? Michael and Marilyn running along the road, whether it's, you know, the way that Marilyn and Bill's house, or Marilyn and Bob, not Bill. God, names, DJ. The way their house is put together, you know, the way that the scene is staged when Kit is telling his parents that he has cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the camera switches to outside the house so we don't always hear the conversation. Like, that's a really interesting move, because as Michael says, it was the most painful 20 minutes, or most, like, excruciating 20 minutes of my life. Mm-hmm. Like, and I like those moments when we are sort of denied sound, so we kind of have to grapple with what silence means.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that those are formal touches that don't, like, beat you over the head, necessarily.
Yeah.
But I think work stylistically.
Yeah, and they also just sort of work for that kind of moment. It's like, with that kind of emotion, it's common for folks to not hear or not perceive something being said, or something. Like, or people are talking and all you can hear is the sort of faint, sort of echoey sound, as opposed to hearing the real voices. I find that really emotionally evocative. I really like the choice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, all of the scenes that you're talking about are sort of parts of the movie proper. I will say one thing about all of the scenes that are used to reference Michael's sitcom obsession, where we get all of these sort of, like, fake flashbacks to his life as a kid, where he's a sitcom character,
right?
Because obviously those are part of the movie as well. What did you think of those?
Well, in much the same way that I thought the final breakaway where he's interviewing Kit, the fictional version, I thought they worked fine. I didn't hate them as much as the critics seemed to, who thought they got in the movie's way. But I was just kind of like, they don't last long enough to really do much. And I'm not, they don't always seem to have an organic connection to whatever happens is happening in the diegetic present. So I'm not always sort of kind of confused as to what they were doing. I don't know that we needed as many as we got. Like, I think one would have been sufficient.
And whereas I feel like there needed to be more so that they could have half a chance of making sense.
Right, yeah.
Because of that lack of connection to what's happening in the diegetic reality. I really, 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 really despised the use of that fake sitcom motif in this movie. I feel like it got in the way so much for me. And it's annoying because as a standalone typical movie, this works so well that adding that concept to me almost ruined it for me. Like, that's how strongly I feel about these those scenes.
Well, I can see that because I had the same response to Kevin Can Fuck Himself, that movie, that show that we watched like one episode of and didn't finish for exactly that reason.
Exactly.
Because I really do think that people are kind of misunderstanding the point of a sitcom. Like, and particularly a three-camera sitcom.
Exactly.
So I agree with you that I think that they are jarring and not as... I think that they work... They may have worked on the page, but I don't necessarily think they worked on the screen quite as effectively.
I'd have to see the page. I'm guessing I would say that they didn't even work on the page.
I need to read the book to see if, like, where this is coming from. Like, where who came up with this stylistic choice.
Because it's the kind of thing that I could see it working in a book.
Right.
But actually trying to have it play out on screen.
Right.
You know, creates a different feeling.
Yeah. But overall, I would say that we really liked this movie. It was quietly devastating, is how I described it. So, obviously, being the overwrought person that I am, I thought that was quite suitable to my temperament.
And I liked it, too, as the person who normally doesn't like emotional stuff.
Right. Well, give us just a moment, and we'll be right back to do deep cuts. All right, well, I'm not going to belabor this point because, quite honestly, I'm not sure I could get through it without completely losing my composure. But I will say that part of the reason, perhaps, that I felt this film so deeply was that, you know, in the last, not even 10 years, like 7 or 8 years, you know, I've lost my aunt to cancer. My other aunt has had breast cancer. My mother has had breast cancer. My dad has had prostate cancer, and we thought it had spread to his lymph nodes just recently. So, like, I've had this on my mind a lot, and having to deal with what cancer means in terms of the temporality of one's existence, not to over-jargonize it, but that's kind of how I think about it. Like, you know, because cancer kind of puts an upper limit sometimes on how long you can expect to be in this world. Like, it doesn't have to, but you know what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, it makes you reconsider how much time you have left.
Yeah.
And that's something that I don't always have a very easy time contending with, I'll be quite frank. And so I think that part of the reason I found this film so devastating was for that reason, that it's been on my mind so much recently. And there's a moment in the film where Kit kind of collapses in the shower, like, and Michael has to rush to care for him. And I almost had to stop the movie. Like, it was almost too much for me to handle. Which that doesn't, I mean, I get overwhelmed by feelings a lot, but very rarely does it come to the point where I'm like, I need to shut this off or I'm going to lose whatever is left of my sanity. I didn't, as it turns out. And I actually think that this movie was very cleansing and cathartic for that reason. And it's a good example of why I think films like this can really do a lot of work for us personally. Like, film in general can help us sort of work through our traumas and our emotional baggage. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate that this film was so honest about the struggles that you go through. And because I think it gives not equal attention to Kit and Michael, but I do think that it shows them each in their own way contending with the finitude of one's existence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like I said, it's just cancer really, really fucking sucks. And I know that seems banal, but it's like this film really reminds me of, you know, how many people have to deal with that particular aspect in their life. And I can see why Michael would be so overwrought about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Or maybe he's an appropriately amount of rot.
Yeah. No, because I would say the thing that I give his character so much kudos for is when facing the prospect of watching yet another person he loves go through this, it's like he didn't even hesitate.
Right.
He just sort of stepped right up and volunteered to do it again.
And, you know, one of my favorite moments, because, you know, they're sleeping in separate beds for a while, but then he goes in and gets in bed with Kit, and, like, puts his, you know, embraces him, and like, mm-hmm. I just love that moment. Because it's, you know, a symptomatic that sometimes things matter more than whatever fights you've been going through. That when the chips are down, you can rely on them.
Yeah.
And I also like that they, it shows them being sexually intimate even when Kit is dying. Like, because, mm-hmm. you know, we sometimes don't think that terminally ill people can have desire. But I appreciated that it gave that kind of moment of sexual intimacy even in the midst of illness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I actually managed to keep my composure, so I'm very proud of myself. So while I'm still not crying, I'm going to move right along into our one of our favorite segments in a little lighter note to end with. Are you even gay? I'm going to give the lead in, but Aaron's the one who gets to harass me indirectly. So,
spoiler alert.
Well, I mean, it's a short segment. There's not much to spoil. So, Aaron, I have to tell you, I watched a really good movie last weekend.
Oh, really? What movie was that, TJ?
It's something I had never seen before, mm-hmm. and it was The Devil Wears Prada.
I'm sorry. I need you to say that again. Make sure that everyone can hear that. People who are doing other things, they might be distracted while they're listening. Say it nice and clear for them.
I watched The Devil Wears Prada for the first time.
So you're saying many, many years ago for the first time you watched The Devil Wears
You're
Prada.
Taking way too much pleasure in this, I can tell already. No, I mean, I watched The Devil Wears Prada for the first time last week because I'm a very bad homosexual.
Yes, you are. Bad gay. Bad
I mean,
gay.
Obviously I've known about it. I know what it's about. The memes proliferate across the internet. Mm-hmm. Like, the scene where Anne Hathaway's character walks in and someone says, are you wearing, and the blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, I am. And, you know, obviously I know all of that. Mm-hmm. But I have never, for some reason, watched it. And I loved it. I mean, it's a brilliant performance. And I will go on record as saying that I may still insist that Glenn Close is a better actress as a whole than Meryl Streep. But I think that Meryl Streep shines in roles where she's not just impersonating someone. I mean, obviously she's imitating Anna Wintour, but not really. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, she's a fictional character, and I think there's a lot of, like, richness to her characterization.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a really... that's one of the best roles I've ever seen Meryl Streep in.
Yes.
Like, she is truly divine, because she's obviously a cold hard bitch with a deep sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really enjoy the movie. We'll do an episode about it. I mean, there aren't really gay characters in it, surprisingly, for a movie that's set in the New York fashion scene, mm-hmm. and there are, like, the only arguably gay character is Stanley Tucci,
yeah.
who is not even diegetically gay as such.
But it's focused on the women.
I know, but still, where's the gay best friend? Like, this is 2006.
It's focused on the women. That's the
thing.
So is Sweet Home. It doesn't have to be about men. There can be movies about women.
Well, that's true. I will concede that. I'm just saying there could have been a gay best friend. They could have at least made it clear that Stanley Tucci's obviously gay character was gay. But anyway.
Didn't they?
I don't know that it was ever specifically mentioned.
I couldn't imagine it being clearer.
I mean, I really do love Stanley Tucci, though. He is exquisite. But anyway, I digress. The point is I watched it. I'm deeply ashamed, however, that I had not seen it before 2023.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you probably have a question now.
Well, see, I can't really ask the normal, like, are you even gay, because you are now. But were you gay before? When we met, were you even gay? When you decided to move in with me, were you even... When you started this podcast, were you even gay?
I mean, yes, I am. I mean, it is a gaping hole in my film knowledge that has all been amply filled.
Mm-hmm. And making a butt sex joke doesn't make you any more gay. That doesn't fix this.
Sorry, that was a really loud laugh that I'm going to keep in this recording. But yes, I am still gay. Yes, I was gay when we moved in together. Yes, I was gay throughout my life. It's just I somehow missed this. For the life of me, I don't even know why. I mean, I was in college when this came out. I don't know why I didn't watch it. I don't know why I haven't watched it at any point in the last 17 years. It's just something that is...
I don't know either, people. I don't know either.
I mean, if you could see the look of absolute raw contempt on his look, on his face,
it's
right
true.
Now. Raw contempt and deep, deep, deep disappointment.
Yes.
You would be amazed and aghast.
It
anyway,
is, it's now, all that, true.
Now that I've Moira rosed my way through this whole exchange, I guess you've already asked the question. I have answered the affirmative that yes, I was and am and will always be gay. I guess we can move right along. All right, well, thank you all so much, as always, for listening to us here at Queens of the Bees. We have a very exciting slate coming up for you in this year of our Lord 2023. We're not going anywhere. We love doing this show. We love all of you who listen to us. We love that some of you have stayed faithful, even though we haven't produced an episode in a month and a half. But we're back. We're going to be back on our regular schedule. We're going to be talking about gay shit from now until forever.
Mm-hmm.
So be prepared. We'll talk about gay stuff, old, new, in between, you know, whatever. Whatever we feel like talking about, really. There's lots of gay content, so, anyway. So, Aaron, do I even bother to ask about your social media channels? I know I shouldn't, but I feel like I have to.
I mean, you can always ask. I won't really have an answer, but...
I mean, he is wise enough to have been on a very sparse social media diet, which I cannot recommend highly enough. But for those of us who are more terminally online, you can find me... TJ on Twitter at TJ West and the number 3. You can also find me on Instagram at Thomas West, the number 3. But you can also find our Queens of the Bees podcast Instagram account at Queens of the BS without the apostrophe. So please do follow us there, where we give bite-sized reviews, not just the films we and TV shows that we cover, but also other things that we're watching throughout the week, because we certainly watch things that aren't gay sometimes. You can also follow and subscribe to my newsletter called Omnivorous over at Substack, which is very gay. There's lots of gay stuff on there, because, of course, I'm gay. Even though I didn't watch The Devil Wears Prada until last week, I'm still very gay.
I'm not sure about that.
Whatever. So please do subscribe there if you have the chance, because I do try to, you know, write about queer stuff in one form or another. And lastly, please do take a few moments to rate or review us wherever you listen to your podcast, particularly Apple, because that's where everybody gets their podcast. We do appreciate everyone who takes the time to do that, because it really helps us to gain visibility and helps us to know what we can do better and who we're satisfying and who we're not. So if you have any negative feedback, please send that to Aaron. He'll be more than happy to absorb it. I will cry and go hide under the blanket if I get any bad criticism. Anyway, but we don't need to belabor that point. So please do rate or review us if you get the chance. So, for Queens of the Bees, I am TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will see you next week.